Welcome back to the deep dive. So last time we really got into the fundamental science of green hydrogen, you know, how you can actually split water with renewable energy to get this incredible clean fuel. But knowing the science, that's really just the prologue, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, the shift we're tracking now, and this is really the mission for you in this deep dive, is that incredibly hard jump from, a theoretical concept to an industrial reality.
Right.
Think of it this way. The tech is proven. We know it works. But the global system to actually support it just doesn't exist yet. The question isn't if it works anymore, it's how. How do we build this whole ecosystem safely, digitally, and of course, economically?
That's a huge distinction. We're going from lab coats to hard hats, from chemistry to what, civil engineering, global finance, logistics?
Exactly. It means we have to master all those non-technical things that, frankly, are arguably more complex than the electrolyzers themselves.
And when you start talking about that level of complexity and that much money, the conversation always turns to risk.
Always. You're committing billions in capital. The first question is always about mitigating risk.
Okay, let's unpack this,
Yeah.
because when we talk risk, hydrogen itself is just different. It's the most common thing in the universe, but its properties create these really unique hazards. So why is it so much harder to manage than something like, say, natural gas, which we've been using for a century?
It really boils down to three physical traits that just force us to completely rethink safety. First up is its density, or really its lack of density.
It's super light.
It's the lightest element, about 14 times lighter than air. So to store any useful amount of energy, you have to compress it like crazy. We're talking between 200 and 700 bar.
Wow.
And that kind of pressure just immediately raises the stakes for keeping it contained.
Okay, so high pressure is one thing, but what if it does leak? How does it behave then?
And that's the second key property, diffusivity. It is incredibly quick to escape. I mean, it just zips through the tiniest crack. Now, outdoors, that can actually be a good thing. It dissipates.
But indoors.
Indoors or in any confined space, you can get a dangerous concentration building up almost instantly. You need these ultra-robust seals, and you need real-time monitoring everywhere.
And crucially, you can't see it, you can't smell it. If it builds up,
You wouldn't know.
you wouldn't know until it's far too late. And its flammability range is just enormous, wider than almost anything else we use as fuel. It can form an explosive mix with air from as low as 4% all the way up to 75%.
That's a massive window for ignition.
It's huge. Natural gas is much, much narrower. So you combine that rapid escape artist quality with a huge flammability range, and well, continuous detection becomes completely non-negotiable.
And that dynamic is so important for the public perception, right? That whole historical stigma around hydrogen. But beyond fire, you mentioned the hardware itself is under threat.
It is a very unique threat. When you take high-strength metals, like the specialized steel for these high-pressure tanks, and you expose them to hydrogen, you get something called hydrogen embrittlement.
Okay, explain that. It sounds pretty bad. Think of it like a microscopic invasion. The hydrogen atoms are so tiny, they actually squeeze their way into the metal's crystal structure.
Into the steel itself.
Right into the lattice.
Yeah.
And once they're in there, they mess with the internal bonds. They act like these tiny little wedges that turn a strong, flexible metal into something brittle. A tiny, invisible flaw can become a massive structural weakness. It's a recipe for catastrophic failure without any visible warning signs.
That's a fascinating and frankly terrifying detail. And if you don't compress it, you can liquefy it for transport, but then you've got the cryogenic hazard.
Yeah, and that's a whole other world of risk. We're talking minus 253 degrees Celsius.
That's just a few degrees above absolute zero.
It is. Just handling it requires incredibly specialized gear, materials that don't shatter at that temperature, and just intense safety training. A tiny splash is instant severe frostbite. And if you have a breach in containment, that liquid expands 850 times as it turns back into a gas. The pressure risks are enormous.
So, if this is ever going to go global, we need rock solid standards. How do you actually manage all these risks at scale?
It comes down to compliance and preparation. First, ironclad adherence to the rules. In the U.S., that's NFPA 2, the Hydrogen Technologies Code. Globally, it's the ISO 19880 series for fueling stations. These aren't suggestions, they're the bedrock. No compliance, no insurance, no financing. Period.
And if something does go wrong, you can't just call the regular fire department.
Absolutely not. Standard firefighting protocols, like using water or foam, can be completely ineffective or even make things worse. Hydrogen fires are often invisible in daylight. They burn incredibly hot, but they don't radiate heat in the same way. So your emergency response plan, your ERP, has to be specialized.
What does specialized mean for a first responder walking into that situation?
It means the ERP defines roles for hazmat teams and specially trained firefighters. It means using systems like dry powder or inert gases to smother the flame. And crucially, it often means training responders to let it burn. If the leak can't be safely sealed, letting it burn itself out is often safer than letting an invisible, unburnt cloud of explosive gas spread.
That's a total shift in thinking, from putting the fire out to managing the gas.
It's a complete philosophical shift.
Yeah.
And it relies entirely on having instant, accurate data, which, you know, is a problem that only digitalization can really solve.
You've hit on the perfect transition. You can't manage all that. The pressure, the diffusion, the invisible risks with an old school analog gauge and a clipboard.
Not a chance.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How does Industry 4.0 become the backbone for all this, for making these new mega facilities both safe and efficient?
Well, the biggest tool that's changing the game is the digital twin. And this isn't just, you know, a 3D blueprint. It's a living virtual replica of the actual plant.
A living replica.
Yes. So first, you use it for optimizing operations.
Mm-hmm.
It's tracking water use, energy input, electrolyzer efficiency, everything in real time. Operators can adjust production on the fly based on, say, the price of renewable electricity.
So it's about maximizing the financial return.
That's a huge part of it, yes.
Yeah.
But its safety function is, I would argue, even more valuable. With the digital twin, you can model disaster scenarios without risking a single person or piece of equipment.
So you can basically crash the plant in a simulation to see what happened.
Precisely. You can simulate a tiny leak in a specific valve and watch how the gas cloud would spread inside the building. You can see exactly when and where it hits that explosive limit.
Which means you can find weak spots, like a corner with bad ventilation, and fix it in the design phase before you've even poured the concrete.
Exactly. Or you can run realistic emergency drills. You can test every failure mode, practice every shutdown procedure, train your staff on crisis response, all inside the twin. It's moving risk management from being reactive to being truly predictive.
That predictive power must be key to building trust. Which brings up another kind of trust, transparency. How do we know that green hydrogen is actually green, that the electricity used to make it was 100% renewable?
That is a huge question. And this is where something like blockchain comes in. You need an unchangeable distributed ledger for that end-to-end traceability.
So it's not just tracking the hydrogen.
No, it's tracking its birth certificate. The ledger records the timestamp and the GPS coordinates of the solar farm or wind turbine that generated the electron that split the water molecule. It creates a tamper-proof chain of custody.
So you can verify it from source to destination. If you're a buyer in Rotterdam, you can see definitive proof that the hydrogen you're buying from the Middle East came from a specific solar field.
That's the mechanism. It's what underpins the green certification schemes and makes global trade even possible. It provides that financial and regulatory trust.
Okay, so digitalization brings a new risk, cyber attacks. Connecting all this physical equipment, the operational technology, the OT to IT networks must change the threat landscape completely.
It flips the priorities completely. In traditional IT security, you're worried about confidentiality, you know, protecting customer data.
Right.
With OT security in a hydrogen plant, you're not worried about a data leak. You're worried about a remote command opening a valve. The priority is system availability and physical safety.
You're not worried about someone stealing a customer list. You're worried about them causing an explosion.
That's precisely the threat model. An attacker could get in through an unsecured sensor and start overriding safety limits, messing with cooling cycles, causing real physical damage. The financial loss from that kind of disruption and damage is so much greater than any data theft.
That's a profound shift. Okay, let's shift gears now from digital safety to economic viability. The biggest barrier right now is still cost. Specifically the CapEx, the huge upfront cost for the electrolyzers. What's happening in R&D to bring that cost down?
The race is absolutely on. And it's really focused in two areas. The first is just better, cheaper materials for the electrolyzers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Take PEM electrolyzers. They're great. They're fast. But they rely on this really expensive component called a Nafion membrane.
And what's so special about Nafion that makes it so pricey?
It's a fluorinated polymer. So it's complex and expensive to make and hard to scale cheaply. So the research now is aggressively looking at alternatives, things like polybenzimidazole, PBI, or SPEEK. The key is that they're non-fluorinated, which could drastically slash the material cost.
So that's making the components cheaper. What about making the process itself more efficient?
For pure efficiency, you look at solid oxide electrolyzers, or SOEs. They run hot. Really hot, like over 700 degrees Celsius.
That sounds like a drawback.
It's actually their biggest advantage, especially for industry. It means they can use waste heat from a nearby factory or chemical plant to help power the water splitting process.
Ah, so you're recycling energy that would otherwise just be lost.
Correct. You're using both electricity and thermal energy. That hybrid input lets them reach efficiencies way higher than other types, sometimes close to 90%. It's a huge win for decarbonizing an entire industrial site.
And what about just using less of the expensive stuff in the first place? I'm thinking of the precious metals.
That's where nanotechnology is the hero. Your classic fuel cells and electrolyzers need platinum as a catalyst. Nanotech lets us create these nanocatalysts. They get the absolute maximum bang for your buck from every single atom of platinum.
How does that work in practice?
By creating nanoparticles, you maximize the surface area. So instead of a thick layer, you have this incredibly thin distributed film where every atom is working. It boosts the catalytic activity so much that you need way less of the precious metal, which directly cuts the capital cost of the hardware.
Okay, we've covered production, cost, but you have to move this stuff. Transportation is a huge logistical bottleneck.
It is. And if high-pressure tanks and cryogenic liquids are hard, the really promising solution for long-distance transport is something called liquid organic hydrogen carriers, or LOHCs.
How do they get around the physics problem?
Instead of just containing hydrogen, you chemically bind it to a stable, non-flammable organic liquid. Think of it like a rechargeable liquid battery for hydrogen.
So you ship this liquid?
You ship the liquid, which can be handled with infrastructure, very similar to what we use for gasoline or diesel today. At the destination, you run it through a process that releases the hydrogen, and then you can ship the empty carrier liquid back to be reloaded.
The real benefit there is leveraging existing infrastructure. Tankers, pipelines, storage tanks. That's a massive shortcut.
It's a game changer. It creates the logistical stability you need to even think about cross-ocean trade routes.
So what does this all mean for the world right now? Let's zoom out from the lab. Where is this stuff actually being deployed at scale?
Well, we're seeing three really distinct models emerge globally. First, in Europe, you have the hydrogen valleys. These are integrated hubs.
Not just one plant.
Not at all. They're entire ecosystems, production, storage, distribution, and use, all in one geographic area, often tied to a huge renewable source like offshore wind in the North Sea. They're like these living laboratories proving out the whole supply chain.
Then you have the second model, which is just pure scale, the mega project.
That's right. You see this in places like the Middle East and Australia, where you have vast, cheap sun and wind. The scale is just staggering. Look at the NEOM project in Saudi Arabia. They're aiming to produce 650 tons of green hydrogen a day.
For export.
For export, mainly to places like Japan and Germany. But that introduces another layer of complexity because you can't easily ship pure hydrogen.
Right, so they convert it, usually to ammonia.
That's the critical step.
Yeah.
They turn the green hydrogen into green ammonia, which is much easier to ship.
Yeah.
Then the receiving country has to convert it back into hydrogen. That extra step and the energy you lose doing it, that's sort of the cost of entry for global trade right now.
And finally, you have these smaller but maybe more impactful examples, resilience in remote communities.
These are, for me, some of the most compelling stories. You see places like Tokelau in the Pacific, which is now nearly 100% solar, using batteries and hydrogen to get off imported diesel. Or El Hierro in the Canaries, using wind and hydro with hydrogen for long-term storage. They prove that this technology can create true energy independence, where a big grid just isn't an option.
So we've gone from safety standards to digital twins to nanomaterials and these massive global projects. It's clear this revolution isn't one thing. It's a whole system being built at once. It's a movement in progress.
It is, and this raises an important question. Our sources lay out a pretty clear timeline for you to think about. We're in what they call the foundation building phase right now, from 2020 to 2025. It's all about policy, pilots, getting the standards right.
Okay.
But the experts project the real tipping point, the full integration and global trade phase,
mm-hmm.
where you have huge cost-competitive trade routes and hydrogen is used in things like aviation and for seasonal power storage, that's not expected to really peak until phase three, between 2035 and 2050.
So that's still 15 to 25 years away from full maturity.
It is. So the real question for everyone today, for policymakers, for investors, is whether the support we're seeing now, the tax credits, the financing, the push for standards, is enough? Can it be sustained and amplified to actually pull that timeline forward to get us to phase three by, say, the early 2030s or maybe even sooner?
Yeah.
It's really a race against the calendar.
You have to hope that necessity is the mother of acceleration because the need to decarbonize is right now. Thank you for walking us through this next crucial phase of the green hydrogen revolution. This was fantastic.